All right, Mr. Donahue, I do not doubt God's ability to communicate as clearly or as mysteriously as he so desires. God had a purpose for inspiring the scriptures in exactly the way that he did. That is why, for example, there are passages which seem to be in contradiction and they're difficult to reconcile. This is that unbelievers use to attack the credibility of the Bible. God could have written the Bible with none of those, yet and he wouldn't have given the unbelievers a leg to stand on. Yet he chose to put those in there. Anyway, this rebuttal I'd like to focus mostly on Mr. Donahue's biblical arguments. I will use my next rebuttal period for his various arguments about instances in which the Catholic Church has discredited itself or contradicted itself. In that vein, first, Mr. Donahue appealed to 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. All scripture is inspired by God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect or complete, fully equipped for all good works. He asked, if scripture is able to make us complete and fully equipped for all good works, what more do we need? Scripture alone suffices. Read the passage carefully. St. Paul says that scripture is profitable and it is useful for making a man complete, fully equipped for all good works. St. Paul sets the completion of the man of God as the goal in view, and he recommends Scripture as a means towards achieving that goal. In other words, this sentence says that Scripture is a means which is profitable towards completing the man of God. It does not say that Scripture is the only means or a sufficient means to complete the man of God. Some analogies are in order. Lifting weights is profitable for making a man a complete, well-rounded baseball player. Studying mathematics is profitable for making a man a complete engineer, fully equipped for every design task. Spraying plant food in a garden is profitable for bringing the garden to its completion or perfection. Yet, lifting weights alone will not make one a great baseball player. Studying mathematics alone will not make one a competent engineer. And spraying plant food alone will not make a perfect garden. While we're at it, we can draw a biblical analogy as well. James 1:4 says, "Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Yet we know that steadfastness is not the only virtue necessary for the Christian life. Love, for example, is also essential. Similarly, Scripture contributes towards perfecting the man of God and fully equipping him for every good work. This does not equate to Scripture alone being sufficient to render the man of God complete, fully equipped for every good work. We may summarize the logical principle at work here, that X is efficacious towards completing Y does not necessarily imply that X is of itself sufficient to complete Y. There are further problems with Mr. Donahue's interpretation of this passage. He says that all Scripture refers to the completed Old and New Testament, but that didn't exist until decades after St. Paul wrote this epistle. Did the teaching of 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 have to wait decades to become applicable? Or was it applicable immediately? In reality, the reason St. Paul says that Scripture is inspired, etc., is because this is a statement about the nature of Scripture. It describes the qualities of Scripture, just as the statement, "all men are rational animals," describes the nature of man. But just as it would be absurd for me to say that John Smith, who will be born in the year 2020, is a rational animal because he doesn't exist yet, so it would be absurd to have St. Paul saying that the completed New Testament is inspired by God when it didn't exist yet. He would have to have said that the completed New Testament will be inspired by God. Certainly, St. Paul's statement in 2 Timothy 3 is true of whatever Scripture has come into existence since Paul wrote it. Yet, at the time he wrote it, his statement was true of the Scripture then existing, which is only part of the whole. Note that carefully. St. Paul's statement can be truly predicated of a part of Scripture. But since Mr. Donahue thinks that this statement teaches sola scriptura, he cannot admit that it is true of a part of Scripture. He has to insist that it is only true of the completed whole. My interpretation allows this text to speak in its own context, whereas Mr. Donahue's force is an anachronism. Next, Mr. Donahue appealed to an interpretation of Revelation 20:12, that the books which are opened at the general judgment are the books of the Bible. I've checked about a dozen scholarly commentaries on Revelation, Catholic and Protestant, and I've found a consensus that the books referred to in this passage are metaphors for God's record of the thoughts, words, and deeds of the ones who are judged. When we stand before the great white throne, God will open up this record of our deeds, and we will be judged based upon its contents, good or bad. The NIV and New Revised Standard Version translations of this passage bring this out very clearly. They render it, "The dead were judged according to their works, as recorded in the books." the books record their works. We see this metaphor repeatedly in sacred scripture, of God possessing a record book of our lives. In Psalm 193, verse 16, David says, "And in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." End quote. In Isaiah 65, verse 6, after recounting the deeds of the wicked, God declares, "Behold, it is written before me. I will not keep silent, but I will repay." Malachi 3:16 says, "Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord gave attention and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who esteem his name." We see this metaphor also in non-inspired Jewish and Christian apocalyptic writings. Many of these works are roughly contemporary with the inspired apocalypse of St. John, and thus we should expect them to share with St. John a similar metaphorical vocabulary. Now, 1 Enoch 97:6 says to the wicked that at their judgment, "All the words of your unrighteousness shall be read out before the great Holy One, and your faces shall be covered with shame." 2 Enoch 52:15 declares, "For all these things, that is, men's righteous and wicked deeds, will be laid bare in the weighing scales and in the books on the day of the great judgment." 2 Baruch 24:1, "For behold, the days come and the books shall be opened in which are written the sins of all those who have sinned." The Ascension of Isaiah 9:21-22 reads, "Behold, one of the angels who stood nigh showed me a book, and he opened it. And the book was written, but not as a book of this world. And he gave it to me, and I read, and lo, the deeds of the children of Israel were written therein." Not the book of Isaiah, a different work attributed to Isaiah. Further confirmation comes from the Apocalypse of Zephaniah. Now, Mr. Donahue appealed to Romans 2:16 as supporting his exegesis of this passage in Revelation. St. Paul says that according to my gospel, God will judge every man according to their works. This simply means that my gospel teaches that God will judge every man according to his works. Next, Mr. Donahue appealed to 1 Corinthians 13 as teaching that prophecy would cease after the completion of Scripture. Even if his interpretation of these passages were correct, that is irrelevant to papal and ecclesiastical infallibility. Infallibility is not prophecy by another name, as you have stated in previous debates. It need not involve any supernatural revelation. Infallibility is God's promise that he will providentially protect the church from falling into error, and he can accomplish this through ordinary means. This is similar to what some Protestants, such as R.C. Sproul, believe about how God providentially ensured that the church would collect the correct canon of the New Testament. So, the process by which the Pope or the bishops assembled in council decide whether to define a dogma is no different from the process by which I form my own personal theological opinions. They study the arguments for and against, and they form a judgment using their own natural human faculties as to whether the doctrine is properly derived from the original Christian revelation. Yet, of course, God will ensure that their judgment is correct, whereas he might allow me to fall into error. That having been said, many Catholic saints have prophesied, so I still feel obligated to refute Mr. Donahue's exegesis of this passage. My position on 1 Corinthians 13, verse 8 to 10, is that the phrase, "when the perfect comes," refers to the perfect knowledge of God that the blessed souls have in heaven, not necessarily at the second coming of Christ, but whenever an individual enters heaven, that is when the perfect comes. The first feature of this passage that supports my interpretation is St. Paul's word choice. When in verses 8 and 10 he says that prophecy, knowledge, and the imperfect will pass away, he uses the verb katargeo. Throughout this epistle, St. Paul uses this word in an eschatological sense. In verse 2:6, he uses it for the doom awaiting the rulers of this age. In 6:13, for the destruction of awaiting food and belly. In 15:24, for the dethroning of every ruler and every authority and power. And in verse 15:26, for the destruction of the last enemy, death, as David Garland points out in the Baker Exegetical Commentary. This militates in favor of an eschatological interpretation of the verses of present concern. Next, in verse 12, St. Paul says, quote, "For now we see," that is, see God, "for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face." Viewing through a mirror dimly is a metaphor for indirect vision. In our present state, we know God indirectly, through intermediaries such as our consciences, his works, and his revelation. Yes, Scripture itself is one of the means by which we see God in a mirror dimly. On the other hand, seeing face to face is a metaphor for immediacy. As Garland points out, face to face, mouth to mouth, and eye to eye are Old Testament idioms that imply that something comes directly, without, not through, an intermediary or medium. "Then we shall see face to face. In heaven, we will have an immediate knowledge of God. We will be like him because we will see him as he is." 1 John 3:2. St. Paul continues, Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I also have been fully known. Then I will fully know God, just as I also have been fully known by God. Ladies and gentlemen, God sees us directly. He doesn't read about us in a book. So in order for God, for us to know God, just as God knows us, we have to see Him directly. And no amount of Scripture could make it possible for us to see God as God sees us immediately, for the very fact that Scripture is a medium. Only the light of glory suffices. Hence, this passage refers to entering heaven, not to receiving the completed Scripture. Lastly, on this passage, Mr. Donahue established at some length that the part must be of the same nature as the whole. My exegesis satisfies this criterion. The part and the whole both refer to the knowledge of God. I now have some time to address papal infallibility. Mr. Donahue presented a dilemma. Whether Pope Adrian VI was right or wrong to assert papal infallibility, the Pope must be infallible, supposedly. I can break one of the horns of this dilemma simply by reading the definition of papal infallibility from the First Vatican Council. Quote, when the Roman pontiff speaks ex cathedra, that is, when in the exercise of his office as shepherd and teacher of all Christians, in virtue of his supreme apostolic authority, he defines a doctrine concerning faith or morals to be held by the whole church, he possesses, by the divine assistance promised to him in Blessed Peter, that infallibility which the divine Redeemer willed his church to enjoy in defining doctrine concerning faith or morals. End quote. We see here that papal statements are only guaranteed to be infallible under certain narrowly defined conditions. Pope Adrian VI's letter to the Diet of Nuremberg does not meet these conditions. He is not addressing the universal church, and he is not defining a dogma. Hence, his statement may be an error according to the definition of papal infallibility of Vatican I. Now, is Adrian VI in fact an error? Partially yes and partially no. He is correct that it is possible for a Roman pontiff to teach heresy and become a heretic. However, if this were to happen, he would immediately cease to be pope. The sin of heresy excludes one from membership in the Catholic Church, and no one can be the head of the Church if he isn't even a member in the first place. Adrian VI is also wrong to assert that many Roman pontiffs were heretics. At most, one has been. He is wrong to call Pope John XXII a heretic. John XXII taught a theological error, but this error was not a heresy because it did not contradict any dogma which had already been defined. Mr. Donahue also documented that some Catholics did not believe in papal infallibility prior to the First Vatican Council. This is true. Archbishop Purcell himself attended the First Vatican Council and was part of the minority of bishops who opposed the definition of papal infallibility. However, once the question was decided, Archbishop Purcell accepted the definition. In any case, papal infallibility was not something that the fathers of the First Vatican Council pulled out of a hat. St. Francis de Sales, for example, defended papal infallibility in almost identical terms in the 16th century. See pages 305 and following in the edition of The Catholic Controversy published by Tan. Looks like this. How much time? 2 minutes? Okay. Sure. Regarding mental reservation or lying, the Catholic Church is well aware of what the Book of Revelation says will happen to liars, which is why the normative Catholic teaching is that it is not permissible to lie under any circumstances. Now, but what about the hard cases? The classic case which has been objected against the Catholic position is, well, what if you are hiding people from someone who wants to murder him, and they come and ask you where he is? To translate this to a modern context, suppose you are hiding Jews from the Nazis, and a soldier comes banging on your door, demanding to know if there are any Jews there. Certainly, you are obliged to keep the secret from the soldier, and, as the Catholic Encyclopedia notes, the easiest way to do so would be to just lie to him. But even though it's the easiest thing to do, you can't do it. Since you can't morally lie to him, what can you do? This is where the Catholic teaching on mental reservation comes into play. You can be evasive, you can answer questions with questions. For example, are you implying that I am not a patriotic German citizen? How dare you? Or you can make a statement which is technically true, but which you intend your interlocutor to misunderstand. For example, you can say, there are no Jews here, meaning hoping that the soldier will understand there are no Jews in this living room, or in this house, but really meaning, well, there are just no Jews in the living room, they're actually in the attic. Now, Mr. Donahue might not like the Catholic teaching on mental reservation, yet in Joshua chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, Rahab the harlot tells an out-and-out lie in order to save the lives of the Jewish spies in Jericho. And what does the Bible say of her? Therefore, God cast Rahab into the lake of fire. No. Hebrews 11:31 lists Rahab among the heroes of faith, and James 2:25 says that she was justified by her good work in protecting the Jewish spies. In such situations, even an out-and-out lie is only a venial sin.